There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Welcome to the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast, a little soupçon of what the real business breakfast will bring you.
If you've had to jump out the car too early to go to a meeting, you've missed one of our interviews, or you just miss us, here's another chance to get a condensed version of the best bits of the business breakfast.
And these are our top stories this morning.
Dubai Eye 103.8 Business Headlines.
In association with insurancemarket.ae.
The royal wedding of Prince Harry to Meghan Markle is likely to provide a boost of $1.4 billion or so, or about 5 billion dirhams, to the UK economy. That's according to the consulting firm Brand Finance, who say those figures include an increase in tourism revenue of more than $400 million and a $67 million boost from the sale of souvenirs.
Menzel Real Estate signed 500 million dirhams worth of development agreements with Tasameem Real Estate this weekend. The pair will develop three new projects in Jumeirah Village Triangle, Dubai Silicon Oasis and Yas Island.
We've got a Shindaga tunnel. We're going to get a Shindaga bridge soon. Drive to work is going to get easier. Six lanes each direction across the Dubai Creek. 394 million dirhams to be spent on the Shindaga bridge project, given the green light, set to be completed in 2022.
Dubai Eye 103.8 Business Headlines.
In association with insurancemarket.ae. Compare insurance for your car, health, home or business with insurancemarket.ae.
Really, Malks? Only one story, I think, from the weekend.
Absolutely. New bridge across Dubai Creek. Whoops.
Oh, I was going for the TGI staff strike in London and Milton Keynes.
There's also been a wedding of sorts on that we've both lucky enough to watch yesterday. Lots of colours, lots of people. What jumped out most for you? What was your top moment, Brandis?
Do you know what? I've looked at it very much from a sort of a business point of view. And my absolute favourite thing about this whole wedding was that you didn't make 20,000 dirhams from it.
This is sad. I hadn't even seen the opportunity. How bad am I? Tell me what I could have done.
Your payday, Malcolm, your big shot, your one chance, and you let it slide. Listeners will know that Malks has a home in Maidenhead, which is how far from Windsor, Malcolm?
4 miles.
What happened in Windsor this weekend, Malcolm?
Don't know. Wedding.
People were making up to 20,000 dirhams a night, 4,000 British pounds, for renting out homes in their area on Airbnb.
It's unbelievable.
It's tourism, is what it is. There was a gym in Windsor that was offering people, it could sleep 16, I'm not sure on what, sleeping bags, cots, for £1,000 a night, 5,000 dirhams, just under.
Do you know what? My brother has been WhatsApping me over the last 3 days, pictures of our house, my dad's house, being completely gutted and repainted.
You think?
I'm beginning to wonder now whether he did this 3 weeks ago in order to get it right for the B&B stuff that he's been running over the last 3 or 4 days. I wouldn't put it past him.
No, I think you may have been gazumped there. No, I'm so interested in, I'm just interested in the numbers and I'm interested in the finances. How much people are making for Airbnb-ing their properties is one of them. Whoever the bright spark was, ho-ho at Marks and Spencer's, who decided to change the signage outside Marks and Spencer's in Windsor. Big black iron sort of lettering on the outside of what is quite an old-fashioned looking Marks and Spencer's, because it's in keeping with the village of Windsor. Windsor a village, technically?
No, it's a town.
A town. Anyway, they took off the signage that said Marks and Spencer's and they made it Markle and Sparkle. Isn't that
fantastic?
Brilliant. I mean, 5 points to you, whoever came out with that. So clever.
And also for the management for saying that's a good idea, let's do it.
It's little things like that, and I just like to think that someone had a bright idea and it's obviously been adopted. So that, I thought, was a really, really neat
It's what a point. Way to go global. I'll bet that picture, because everybody knows the brand around the world, has been picked up in media across the world.
Well, I mean, here we are in Dubai and we're talking about it, and there's Marks and Spencer's here, so don't tell me that there isn't knock-on effects. Also, just having a look at the numbers, we know, as you've heard in our headlines there, 1.4 billion roughly is what it added to the UK economy. That's in tourism, although there's a bit of a debate, isn't there, as to whether or not you actually benefit long-term from tourism for something like a royal wedding.
Look, I mean, I saw the same numbers that you did, and yet the UK Office for National Statistics said that the 2011 wedding of Prince William and Kate Middleton didn't result in a noticeable uptick for the economy, suggesting that it might fall flat. But I think there were a couple of things that were slightly different about this wedding. It wasn't in London. People know London. It involved an American. That's a big tourist market, a source market. And it was in maybe a town that people don't necessarily know so well as they know London, Windsor. And it was great weather. The beauty of Windsor and the castle, the weather, the happy people, the fact that it was a little bit about Hollywood more than it was about politics, a different sort of people, the gap-tooth grin of the Mulroney boys carrying the, I was about to say cape, what do you call it?
It's a train.
Two Canadian sons of friends of
Batman got married this weekend.
But my favourite thing, I think, wasn't the sort of the costume of what's the guy I'm thinking of?
The groom, the best man, the bishop. Where are you going?
Grey hair and a grey suit. What's his name?
George Clooney.
That's the one with the wife in orange, and she looked great. But the big thing that jumped out at me really was the dignity of Doria Ragland, Meghan's mum, there by herself, had a tough old week of it. She looked fantastic. She looked lovely colours, white hat and a sort of lovely lime green top, sitting there in tears a lot of the time, but with a lot of dignity. My heart went out for her.
And if you'd like to hire Malcolm Taylor to MC your next event, he's available at very reasonable rates.
There's what's her name? Look, the one next to the... what's his name?
Before we have a look at some of the best bits of our interviews this morning, though, staying on the financial side of the wedding, if you were going to cash in from memorabilia, and our very own Richard Dean is over there at the moment, didn't go for the wedding, really, he's gone for the FA Cup, but he has been caught up, as you would be, in wedding fever. He's been talking to us this morning about the atmosphere in the UK at the moment, and he's bought a lot of memorabilia. If you ever look at our Twitter, you can see Richard posing with various bits of wedding memorabilia that he's bought. What do you think, if you were nicking a souvenir from the wedding, what do you think would bring you the most returns in, I don't know, 5-6 years?
Electric E-type Jaguar.
Well, possibly, yes. Wasn't it amazing? No, it wouldn't be. Richard's bought us a commemorative plate. Bless you, Richard. What? But that in 5, 10, even 15, 20 years' time will be worth roughly 30 dirhams.
30 dirhams. I say, you're talking about nicking something that will slip into your handbag nicely.
Or you into want a suit to steal pocket. A piece of cake.
Cake?
Yes.
You're joking.
A piece of wedding cake from the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, so William and Kate's wedding, sold last year, so, 6-7 years after they got married, for £4,000. That's 20,000 dirhams.
How would you do the provenance on that? How would you actually prove? Would you get them sort of say, look, actually, guys, can you, William and Kate, can you actually sort of sign this, that I'm stolen this bit of wedding cake from you?
I mean, you can't, date stamp or DNA a piece of cake, can you?
But how do you know it's from the same cake?
I don't know.
Look, it's all hard and rolled up at the edges.
I have absolutely no idea, but that is the kind of thing that you're after. Something personal, that's what would get you the money if you were selling memorabilia.
This is the Business Breakfast.
Stay one step ahead with Dubai Eye 103.8.
Plenty of stories catching our interest this morning. The high-speed railway between Makkah and Medina been plagued by delays. It's now going to open in September of this year, fully opening in September of next year. Silk Air, which is a regional airline in the Far East, is going to disappear because it's going to merge with its parent company, Singapore Airlines. And President Donald Trump has personally pushed the Postmaster General in the US to double the rates that the US Postal Service charges Amazon.com and other companies to ship packages, according to the Washington Post, because Donald Trump says that they are paying half what they should be. Let's wait for the reaction from Amazon and from the other postal companies. Now, our Winning in Business feature looks at individuals who've made businesses successful and made them grow and last in the UAE. And one person and business that's had a lot of longevity is Dubai Duty Free. And the man who's synonymous with Dubai Duty Free at Dubai Airport is the Executive Vice Chairman of the Dubai Duty Free Group, Colm McLaughlin. We were very pleased to ask Colm about the number of awards that he's won, because he's always in papers and magazines winning a new award. In the last month alone, they've won the Business Travel and Middle East Award for Best Airport for Duty-Free Shopping in the Middle East, 3 Corporate Social Responsibility Awards, and the International Safety Awards in London as well. They've won that for the second consecutive year. And we asked him, does winning in business become a habit and therefore become easier with time?
I think it becomes easier if you continue to be successful in your business. I think the awards are terrific for Dubai Duty Free. I attribute them always to the efforts of our staff and to the guidance and support of His Highness Sheikh Ahmed, who is my boss. I do think it is good for the company. One of the things we're very definite about is marketing Dubai Duty Free. It's part of our brief. And winning awards is a good way to do that. So the answer is yes.
I've lost track of how many pictures I've seen with you holding a trophy or a plaque or a shield or something over the years. I mean, have you kept track? How many pictures have you had taken holding awards?
Well, I don't know how many pictures, but Dubai Duty Free has won over 600 awards.
And Colin over the 30 years?
Over the 30 years. Yeah. And Colin McLaughlin has been given personal awards, about 50 or 55 of them, which I attribute to our team of staff.
You're going to have a very crowded mantelpiece when you finally retire, Colm. I mean, this series is about winning in business, but of course, you've done better than most, I suppose. But over the 35 years you've been at Dubai Duty Free, there must have been challenges, ups and downs. What have been some of the more challenging times for you?
Well, there have been difficult times. You know, there was some wars going on in the region. Then SARS came along and stopped people travelling. One of our decisions at that time was just to be very positive and to make sure all our staff were aware that we were supporting them, that we were there, and it was actually part and parcel of our operation that every day all the managers were to be seen walking around on the shop floor. With the increase in traffic, that creates difficulties. There are now many and required securities at airports that were not there before, so it takes longer for people to come in, and all of these continue to be challenges, but you just face them and manage them and do the best you can.
And I've noticed this a lot, that you've got far more outlets in different parts of the airport. Primarily, it was previously just one major outlet in each of the terminals, but now you've got bits all over the place. And outside the airport, QE2, for instance, Al Maktoum International, you've got other outlets as well, Dubai Duty Free, Irish Village, etc. How many actual outlets have you got now?
We have 36,000 square meters of retail space at Dubai International Airport. We have 4,000 square meters at Al Maktoum International Airport. And if you look forward, that's going to be 80,000 square meters at Al Maktoum International Airport in a few years' time.
How many different shops is that, though, Colin?
We have 234 different shops.
It's massive, isn't it?
Between all of the areas.
Not so much, though. The decisions you've made about how you brand that retail, I find really interesting. If I wander into duty-free in, I don't know, Australia or the UK, you've got a lot of branded standalone shops in there. You've got your WH Smiths, for examples. You might have your different individually branded concessions. I feel like we've got less of that here in Dubai, that it's more kind of a sprawling non-stop duty free. Talk to me about the decisions about how the space is divided up and how the branding works.
In most airports, companies bid for space and they rent space from the airport. In Dubai, it is very different. There's a royal decree in place here, signed by His Highness Sheikh Mohammed, that says all the duty free operation at the airports will be operated by Dubai Duty Free. So when you go through our airport and you see various brands featured, that shop does not belong to the brand. It belongs to Dubai Duty Free. We have an agreement with them. We call it vendor support. The staff that may be there, although they may be dressed in some brand uniform, they're actually our staff and we operate all of it.
What opportunities and challenges, how does that change the way you have to operate then?
Well, we can market all of the thing as one unit. We talk on behalf of Dubai, we help promote the airport, we help promote Dubai. And it is one of our briefs from His Highness Sheikh Mohammed at the very beginning that part of our duty would be to help promote Dubai. And we do in fact spend 2% of our top line income on promoting and marketing Dubai and Dubai Duty Free.
How do you target and market to a customer though that's very different from a normal retail customer? Because obviously, you have a bit of a captured audience, which is a great thing, but you might not have a regular audience in the same way that that a high street shop would, for example.
Well, a lot of the things we do in our marketing is overseas. You know, we are involved, for example, in horse racing in the UK. We have been for many years. We're involved in horse racing in Ireland with the Dubai Duty Free Irish Derby. We're involved in horse racing in Ascot with the Shergar Cup, which we do each August. We own the Dubai Duty Free Tennis Championship. And because we own the weeks on the tour, it gives us a complete free hand in how we use it to promote. And we are told by the ATP and the WTA that the return, media-wise, on our tennis last year was valued at $920 million.
Wow.
And that's a figure that you couldn't possibly afford to buy if you were just advertising or whatever. And so it's very good for Dubai and Dubai Duty Free.
Colin McLaughlin, Executive Vice Chairman of Dubai Duty Free. We'll have you back next year, the year after, and the following 15 years.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
This is the Business Breakfast.
Stay one step ahead with Dubai I 103.8.
We've been speaking this morning to a company that goes live today with its new health service after raising more than $3 million in seed funding. That business is Health at Hand. We've been speaking to the founder and CEO, Charlie Barlow. Let's have a listen now to the business model they've put together and how Charlie thinks it's going to work, because he started by giving us the elevator pitch.
Health at Hand is the first Dubai Health Authority fully licensed telehealth company. And telehealth essentially is the way of actually allowing medicine to translate through mobile phones. So we have a free to download iOS and Android app, which you can download from today. Through the app, you can have a live video consultation with a highly qualified doctor, during the consultation, our doctors, who are all US board certified, trained or above, so they sit in probably the top 10% of all doctors in the UAE in terms of qualification, they can actually listen and look at a patient and their symptoms and then come up with a drugs recommendation or a course of action.
What's the app called?
The app is called Health at Hand. Health at Hand. And as I said, it can be downloaded today.
Okay, so your doctors are sitting here in the UAE.
All our doctors are in the UAE. They're all DHA licensed and they're all able to work legally and with full malpractice insurance on patients in the UAE, correct?
Are they working for you full-time?
All our doctors are full-time with Health at Hand.
Okay. Why would I want to do that? Why would I want to have an appointment via a video call, basically, rather than going and seeing a doctor face-to-face?
Yeah, it's a very good question. There are a number of reasons, really. First of all, we live in a city such as Dubai where the on-demand economy has taken off. So this is a convenience thing. The ability to have a doctor face-to-face consulting with you within 2 minutes, so we have a maximum of 2 minutes waiting time, really transforms your relationship with the doctor and patient. A lot of our consultations, Brandy, are very minor non-emergency things. So for example, a child falls over and cuts themselves. For peace of mind, again within 2 minutes, you can speak to a doctor and actually inquire, do I need to go to the emergency room or not? And then we have time poor people within Dubai, so both working mothers who can't necessarily go to an appointment all the time when they'd wish to, working professionals who can't get away from the office.
But that doctor can't stitch up my child, can't put a bandage on him, can't take a temperature, can they really watch the symptoms and think, child's behaving a little bit as though it has a stiff neck? I mean, do you lose something in not actually sitting in the same room together?
So it's very much worth mentioning, we're not trying to change the whole of primary healthcare. Health at Hand cannot treat every single symptom. Statistics show that up to 70%, though, 70% of walk-in patients to clinics can in fact be treated through video using looking and listening. You mentioned you can't take a temperature through a remote consultation. Well, you absolutely can. And the ability to home monitor patients who might have diabetes, mental health issues, is becoming increasingly prevalent across the telehealth space.
So how much do you pay for this?
So we have an on-demand model and we have a subscription-based model direct to the consumer, to the patient. And the entry level is as little as 7 dirhams per month per user for unlimited video consultations, as I said, with a US board certified doctor.
If I'm paying 7 dirhams per month and I could phone every day if I was a little hypochondriatically inclined, how are you going to make money out of that?
Yeah, again, a very good question. The real beneficiary, aside from the patient, who are huge beneficiaries of this, are the insurance companies. So particularly looking at the UAE market, the loss ratios for health insurers is about 140%, meaning the health insurance model in the UAE is broken. So if we look at other markets and the adoption, it's not going to take long for health insurers to come on board. This will be either copay or standard as part of your policy. So it will be the insurance companies who will be paying for your cover to Health at Hand ultimately.
I'm surprised that the doctors, you said, are covered. They've got insurance against misdiagnosis, particularly when you haven't actually seen the person that you're placing a diagnosis on. I mean, supposing you got it wrong and said, nothing to worry about, that'll get better in a day or two, and they pass away the same day. I mean, that's, and you say, well, you know, you should have come in. Well, where does the cover come from? I mean, I just don't understand why anyone would insure a doctor when they haven't seen the patient.
Yeah, again, it's a question we see quite a lot, Malcolm. There are incidents where telehealth can actually be perceived as being safer than a face-to-face consultation for a number of reasons. First of all, our doctors have the ability to see the full patient history. So our patients can upload, download, and share their health records. We ensure that our patients are the custodian of their health records. So the doctor is possibly even more informed through a telehealth consultation than they are ordinarily. And if we can't treat them, we absolutely won't. We have very, very strict clinical and non-clinical protocols. But as I said, in incidences of, and I'll give you another example, lactation consultancy. This is not a life or death situation. This is a young mother who's at home, who's struggling breastfeeding. They're panicking. They can't necessarily drive to a clinic immediately. They can see a highly qualified doctor through video on their handset and just get the reassurance that they're doing the right thing.
You mentioned the insurance companies coming on board. Are they not on board yet?
So obviously we've only just launched, and it's a chicken and egg. We have to launch our products before we can actually win insurance contracts. We should be announcing a number of contracts throughout the summer of this year, but we can only fully engage with insurance companies once we have a product that's live in the market.
I can see on the sort of surface that this would be a sort of high-level healthcare, sort of some serious concerns, emergency diagnosis being fantastic. I can imagine also a lot of people calling up saying, can I have a sick note? I'm not very well today. All right, you take the day off and I'll send you a sick note. Are they able to work at that level as well?
So Health at Hand, we have some additional features that haven't yet been seen in this market or in fact the wider GCC and Africa. So it does include the likes of sick notes, it includes e-referrals, and by the end of the summer 2018, we'll actually be integrating drug delivery. But our protocols in terms of how we issue sick notes are absolutely as robust as they are in the physical face-to-face environment due to the regulation.
You just see the volumes going up because people don't have to bother getting out of their house to go to a doctor.
If our doctors believe that that patient is clinically worthy of a day off work and it meets the protocols as set out by the Dubai Health Authority, then that can happen.
You have to have the sick note system here is that it goes through the government, though. The government effectively approves each sick note. I had the flu last week. I have one. So you're working with the government on that. Your doctors have government approval to go through the system and issue sick notes.
Absolutely. As I said at the outset, we are the first licensed telehealth company in the UAE by the Dubai Health Authority.
How do prescriptions work, though? How do I actually get a prescription that signed and got the doctor's stamp on it from you?
Yes, so at the moment, regulation in the UAE doesn't allow for e-prescription through a platform like Health at Hand. We can do over-the-counter drugs and deliver these to you, but at the moment, we can suggest a prescription drug and you can then go to your local pharmacy and collect that drug.
So you said 7 dirhams a month for the subscription. What about every consultation? How much will I pay for that?
So 7 dirhams a month allows a member free access to Health at Hand, unlimited number of video consultations each month.
How do the doctors make their money?
So our doctors are all salaried, and they're salaried for a reason.
Are they employed by you?
They're all employed by ourselves, yes.
Can I just ask about the prescription again? You said there that you can recommend a prescription drug and I can go to the pharmacy and ask for it, but the pharmacist is not going to give me a prescription drug unless I have a prescription.
We can still write prescriptions, we just can't do e-prescriptions, so we can't deliver these prescription drugs. So it's still as it would happen in the physical environment.
Why do I need to use a GCC-based teledoctor? I mean, these systems are up and running in the US. If the whole on-demand economy is that it doesn't matter where people are based, why couldn't I just use a US one?
Again, a great question. In theory, you don't need to use a doctor in the UAE. International medical law suggests to prescribe cross-border is not allowed. So when e-prescription is allowable, you would have to have a UAE doctor with matched with a UAE patient. One of the main reasons our doctors are based here and they're hired by us is they have knowledge of the UAE market. So if you need to go to see a specialist, gynecologist, or whatever it might be, we have the knowledge. A doctor in Australia just wouldn't know which hospital to send you to.
Well, very good luck with your going live today. Charlie Barlow, the founder and CEO of Health at Hand.
This is the Business Breakfast.
Stay one step ahead with Dubai Eye 103.8.
Having a look at the future of Dubai, because we know that Dubai is being used as a living testbed at the moment for creating solutions to problems as varied as rubbish collection or improving the health of its citizens. Dubai Future Accelerators. On Thursday, the fourth cycle of the Dubai Future Accelerators programme was completed. Now, each cycle for this programme lasts around 9 weeks. What they do is they take exciting and up-and-coming tech companies, they team them up, they pair them up with government organisations, and they look to see what can be created. Now, our producer Georgia Tolley was down there to see exactly what the fourth cycle of the Accelerators programme had produced, and she spoke to Saeed Masim Al-Falassi. He's the executive director of the Platform of the Future, and he described what had happened during this latest cycle.
It went very well. We had over 70% of all companies participating with us actually have signed an MOU today. So I think it's quite encouraging for us to continue to see the value that we can present as a Dubai Future Accelerator to the various government entities. And we go through a very rigid process. We had over 667 companies apply for the program for this time, which it shows you how popular this program is becoming in different areas of the world. And I think the government entities are also quite excited every cohort by sharing with us more and more challenges that they're trying to find solutions for. So this is quite exciting, because when we started, they used to only share with us a challenge or two at the max. Now we're seeing government entities throwing at us four or five different challenges. If you take, for example, Dubai Municipality, so they're looking at too many different areas. One is constructions, pest control, food safety, so many different areas that they're looking at, and they're really looking forward to our collaboration with all of our alumni and network around the world to bring in the solutions for them.
So you get a sense that the Dubai government entities are really starting to believe in this program.
Definitely, definitely. A lot of them actually, I think this year, because it happens to be the cohort number four, so all of them by now have understood the process of selecting a company, signing an MOU with them, then going into more of a commercial terms and running the pilots. And as a matter of fact, being at the end of the cohort, we see some of the companies actually are moving on into the piloting the projects, which is quite encouraging for us as well.
Where do all these companies come from, and how do they find out about you? Because you really do have people from all over the world. I've spoken to one guy from Shanghai. Well, he's Australian, but he's in Shanghai. I've got one guy who's British, one guy from Texas. So you really have got a global group of cohorts here.
A lot of those companies who participated with us in the first three cohorts have actually been our spokesman everywhere that they go. And these companies are becoming really a part of a community, especially in the startup communities. So they tend to speak about what we do as a government entity, and they've been following us very closely on our social media networks to find out what is the next cohort, what sort of challenges that we're going to throw at them, and we're really seeking them providing solutions. So through the process of creating this alumni, we've also signed up with multiple big universities such as Oxford and MIT to really utilize the networks and students that they are coming through. You won't believe that some companies that come through participate with us could be tens of staff on their payroll, and some of them only three guys. So we really focus on the technology that is coming through and not really on the number of staff that they have for each company. But definitely we're looking to work with the startups who really bring in a whole lot of different level of innovation in solving current solutions.
So how are you measuring your success? Because obviously this was a program set up with very grand ideas. How are you quantifying your success?
So we have set up for ourselves certain number of key performance indicators as a government entity or as a program initiative, which is the Dubai Future Accelerator. Number one is obviously we want to make sure that we have the biggest number of MOUs. We want to make sure that those companies who spent with us 9 weeks discussing their solutions with the various government entities actually end up signing with that government entity. Our next measurement will be is how many of those MOUs being signed actually turning into a pilot and commercial projects that are being rolled out to the community. So it is we work very closely in supervising those government entities to ensure that all those MOUs being signed is actually being translated into a program that is the community is benefiting from.
How much homegrown talent are we seeing?
Every year we really try to tap into innovation everywhere in the world, and we speak to those guys that are from Texas or from South Korea to see what sort of innovation happening in these parts of the world. Surprisingly this year, and actually quite exciting at the same time, that out of the 37 companies participating with us, 11 of them are actually homegrown in UAE. So it's quite exciting to see how those startups can be now a part of solving solutions, but also part of the economy within the city.
So what is next? Is there going to be a fifth cohort?
Definitely. As a matter of fact, we're completely thrilled to see that, well, first of all, we have only 12 different government entities participating with us. And the number of government entities in Dubai far exceeds that number. So we're getting a lot of different requests from those government entities that have not gotten the chance to participate with us to actually work with us now on the next cohorts. So as a matter of fact, next year onwards, we're going to be having 3 cohorts per year instead of 2, allowing more opportunities for other government entities to participate with us. And we've been actually being reached out by federal entities as well to be part of the program. So we are here for the community and to make sure to assist those government entities to provide the best for the residents.
Saeed Masayem Al-Falassi, the Executive Director of the Platform for the Future.
Tomorrow we are going to hear more on the Business Breakfast Show from the Dubai Future Accelerators program. We are going to speak to the CEO of Bodio, who's created a health application that will measure quite how well you're doing.
Oh dear.
That's it on the Business Breakfast tomorrow. We hope you've enjoyed our podcast.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.